Okay. So I am. I'm going to veer off topic today from our regularly scheduled program, mainly because I wasn't feeling well the past few days, didn't have time to prepare our usual topic. So I'm sharing something else that I just had already kind of prepared in my mind.
Are you better?
Yeah, Baruch Hashem, thank God, I am feeling much better. But probably 95%, you know, not 100%. But because of that, we're going to do a different topic today, not another mitzvah, but a topic from the last few weeks' parsha, which I think there's a lot to learn from. And the topic is to understand some lessons from the city of Sodom and its destruction. It's an infamous city, and it's an interesting city to talk about. You know, it's used even in modern-day talk, you know, the idea of sodomy. But it's a city which the Torah describes as somewhat of a paradise in terms of its prosperity. The way it's described in the Torah when it's first mentioned, and this is when, you know, Abraham had his nephew Lot with him, and the two of them had a little tension, and they had to part ways. So Abraham tells Lot, "Well, we have to separate. If you go left, I'll go right. If you go right, I'll go left." And it says that Lot lifted his eyes, and he saw the entire plain of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. Kulo mashke. Before Hashem destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of Hashem, like the land of Egypt going towards Tsoar. So the city of Sodom and its partner Amorah is the other city. They were described as well watered, and they are described like the garden of Hashem, like the Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, like a paradise, a tropical paradise with all sorts of great crops growing and wealth. And it was very prosperous, a very prosperous place. So it says that Lot saw this. He was very, very drawn and enchanted by Sodom. And it says that he chose to move to that area. And Vayisa Lot Mikedem, he journeyed from the east. And they parted one from his brother. This is the separation of Abraham and Lot. So that's the first mention of Sodom.
He didn't go north or south. He just went straight, I think.
He went straight. Well, it says that he went from the east, I guess, towards the west, I guess. I don't know the geography at that point. But the options were left or right or left, and then whatever that orientation was.
The Mikedem probably means to the east rather than from the east.
You think it's to the east? Yeah.
Because he was on the mountain in the middle of Eretz Yisrael.
Right. Okay, I guess that makes sense. I mean, that's but the area was towards the east. I guess that makes sense. But so the Torah talks to the people in Sodom and says people there are ra'im v'chataim. They're evil and they were sinners to God very, very much. Adon l'Hashem ma'od. So they weren't given a very, very praiseworthy title. They're described as ra'im v'chataim, as evil and sinners, evil people who are sinners to Hashem very, very much, exceedingly. So that this is the city that we're talking about here, and he chose to go there. There are many, many descriptions about the wickedness of Sodom. Why were they so wicked? What did they do? I'll share with you one of them that Rashi alludes to. I'm not going to go through today all the stories about how wicked Sodom actually was. But Rashi alludes to one story. And very often, you know, one story kind of tells the entire story of the entire place. So this story sort of encompasses the evil of Sodom. Now, Sodom was most infamous for their lack of charity and tzedakah and caring for guests. They legislated against taking care of guests and against giving out tzedakah. They wouldn't allow it in their city, and they wouldn't tolerate it. So one of the stories that serves kind of as the model, a paradigm for the evil of Sodom, it's based on the pasuk quoted in the parsha in Lech Lech, in Vayera, last week's parsha. It says that Zaka Sodom v'Amora ki rabba, the screaming of Sodom and Amora has been enough. And Chazal say, the rabbis teach us, that Rabba could be understood as the word Reba, as a young woman. A young woman screaming has led to the destruction of Sodom. So who was this young woman that was screaming? So the Gemara tells us that there was a story of a young woman who wanted to give out some tzedakah. She took some bread, and she wanted to give it to a poor person. And she did it very discreetly. She put it into her bucket she was using to go draw water at the well. So she put the bread into the bucket. She walked outside towards the well, and I guess, you know, as she walked towards the well, she gave the bread to somebody who was needy. She was discovered in her, you know, terrible, terrible, devious plan was discovered, and they took her and they killed her in a very cruel and unusual way. They smeared her in honey, and they put her out for the bees, and she was killed in that manner. So this shows us the cruelty of Sodom, but it wasn't just a cruelty because they were cruel. It was a cruelty that was anti-tzedakah. It was anti-helping others. They were very, very selfish people. They wanted to keep it all for themselves. And really it's described this way in the Tanakh, in the book of Yechezkel, in the book of Ezekiel. It says that Hine Zehaya Avon Sodom, this was the sin of Sodom, your sister. Gaon Sivas Lechem, it was a place that was very prosperous. They were satiated with bread, they had plenty of food. The Shavas Hashgate, they had tranquility there, they're very comfortable in their lifestyle. Hayalav Livnosa, both Sodom and its surrounding cities had this great prosperity. Viad Ani Ve'evyon Lohechzika, but they did not support the hand of the poor, the needy. And this is really the way that the prophets highlight the evil of Sodom. So they were totally anti the concept of chesed. But where it comes from seems to be from the source that they were want to keep their wealth for themselves. We have this great prosperous city. We have so much that we can benefit from for ourselves. I don't want to share it with others. That seems to be where Sodom was coming from in terms of their cruelty. But Lot, however, was enchanted and charmed by this city. It looked like there was so much he can gain from moving there. He can gain so much wealth, so much money, so much prosperity. So Lot left from Avraham, went to the city. On the verse that says that Lot traveled from the east, Visa Lot Mikedem, so Rashi quotes from the sages who say that the word Kedem means east, but also could refer to Kadmono Sho'olam, the one who preceded the world, referred to God. And it means that Lot departed from God at that moment as well. He departed from Abraham, he also departed from God. So the question could be asked, why is Lot's choice in moving to Sodom a departure from God? Now the answer might be obvious. When you move to a place of such wickedness, such evil, such cruelty, then obviously you're putting your values behind. But I think there's really two explanations that one can give to sort of define why moving to Sodom was a departure from his devotion to God. So number one, Rav Shlomo Wolbe Zatzal, one of the great Jewish thinkers of our time. So he writes that Lot didn't just leave to go to a prosperous place, but he left behind his teacher, his mentor, his Rebbe, Avraham. You know, a person can be in a very, very challenging environment, but if you have your links to those people who keep you on the right track and who inspire you and keep you focused on what your goals are in life, you can still do okay. If Lot maintained the connection to Avraham, so then it could be even in an environment like Sodom, he still could have maintained his values and his morals. But the minute Lot says, it's more important for me to be in Sodom and focus on trying to gain wealth rather than stick here with my teacher and my mentor, Avraham, so that was departure from God himself, because Lot was then defining his values. And in a further sense, when you choose that the money and prosperity of Sodom is more important than being around this great sage, this great righteous man, Avraham Avinu, so that is very much a statement of your values. There are many points in life, sort of like crossroads in life, where we have to sort of choose ourselves, choose our direction, where we're going. It happens, every once in a while, there's a point we have to make a choice. And very often those choices might be a true definition of who we are. What are our values in life? Where are we going with ourselves? What do we stand for as right versus wrong, as proper versus improper? So Lot was given that choice. I could stick around in an area that may not be as prosperous, but at least in an area that's honest and caring and takes care of others. Or I can move to Sodom where, I can be, the streets are paved with gold, as it were, in Sodom. But the people there are wicked, cruel people. Now, what am I going to choose? And when Lot makes that choice, at this seminal moment that he chooses, I'm moving to Sodom, he's now defined himself. And he said that I'm not one who lives for kindness and for morality and for devoting myself to God. I live for money. Now we find that Lot in Sodom tried to do chesed. He cared for others in Sodom, but that choice itself is already departing from these values. So the Torah tells us that Lot left from the east, which means he left from God himself. That was because he defined himself. Number one, he left his mentor. He left Avraham. And number two, he made a choice that defined his values in life. And those values, what he put his priorities was not morality and ethics and devotion to God. What he put as his priority was his desire to live in a land like Sodom that was filled with so much wealth and prosperity. So this is a big point in Lot's this life, but that really signifies who he was. It's important for us to know as well, at times in life we're put in challenging situations. So at those times, if we have somebody to look back towards for advice and for guidance, inspiration that keeps our moral compass pointing in the right direction, so usually we can handle the challenges. But if we don't have that person. You know, it could be a rabbi, it could be a parent, it could be a friend. There are many people it could be. But you have that person you can go to toward for that advice and that inspiration and just for that encouragement. It makes all the difference. You know, lost that. In his days, he left from his teacher. They couldn't make phone calls or send emails or text each other. That was it. You know, they were kind of cut off. Avram later on went to save his life and Lot was captured. But they weren't in contact with one another. There was no communication anymore. So in our days, we have communication. So even if you're not living in proximity to this person who's your mentor or your inspiration, you can send like a phone call. You can pick up, you know, get a flight and visit. You can keep that connection. But it's important because if we want to be able to withstand challenges in life, we have to have those people we look at as kind of our base. And we go back to them and say, please help me handle this challenge. So that's one of the lessons you get from the story of Sodom. Now when God's about to destroy Sodom, and this is in last week's parsha, so what God makes an interesting comment to himself. The Torah says, Vashem Amar, Hashem said, Hamachas ani mi'Avram asher ni'oseh, can I possibly conceal from Avraham that which I'm going to do? It's a rhetorical question. And it's a very funny question. God's saying to himself, it's as if God has to spill the beans to Avraham. He can't like hold back a secret from Avraham. It's a funny way to put it. As if it's like unheard of. It's impossible. I cannot hold back from Avraham's information. So why is that? So the simple meaning is, Rashi explains, it's because Hashem had promised Avraham the land of Israel. And if I'm going to destroy part of the land, I better tell him first. You know, if I'm going to give you a gift, I'm going to give you a house, but I'm going to knock down half of it before I give it to you. I should let you know I'm knocking down half the house before I give it over to you. So that's the simple meaning. But the question itself makes it sound like, you know, it's impossible I don't share this news with Avraham. You know, Hashem can do whatever he wants. This is Hashem talking to himself. Like, why is it so, you know, just inconceivable that he couldn't share the news with Avraham? So there's an interesting explanation that in this book right over here. This is written by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, who was my rabbi growing up in Atlanta many years back. It's called Biblical Questions and Spiritual Journeys. He discusses here rhetorical questions you find in the Torah. There are many times you find questions which are not there to be answered per se, but they're rhetorical questions. And he actually discusses the concept of a question, and he goes through 18 examples, I think, of different questions you find in the Torah, which are rhetorical questions. You know, the question, Ayeka, God asks Adam, where are you, when he sins? My brother's keeper, the question to Cain. The many, many questions you find in the Torah, and one question he discusses is this question. God asks of himself, how could I conceal from Avraham that which I'm going to do? So he has a long piece on it, but his main point, and I'll just read you a quote from him. His main point is that Avraham wasn't just a regular person, obviously. He wasn't just a righteous person. Avraham was the first person in history to discover God and bring God into the world as a household name, as it were. Now, before Avraham, he had individuals out there that served God, but overall, God was not part of the psyche of the human race. Avraham was the one who was able to discover God on his own and then spread the name of God and monotheism to the entire world. So Avraham is not just somebody who's righteous and pious and close to God. Avraham becomes a partner with God in the creation. That's he describes. Because when God makes the world, God says, okay, number one, I'm creating a world. But number two, the purpose of it is so I have human beings that actually recognize me and follow my will. That's why God puts human beings in this world. So without someone like Avraham to bring that message to the entire creation, then God's world is only half complete. No, the world is here, but nobody knows what they're supposed to do in the world. Avraham's able to say, I've discovered the message of God, I've communicated with God, and I brought that to the entire world. Now I've become a partner in God's creation. So Rabbi Feldman writes, Abraham, the discoverer of God, his beloved and his advocate, the courageous destroyer of the anti-God idols, the first to be in total harmony with God's ways, he who is from the other side and against the pagan world, he who alone represents the God who is alone, who is God's conduit to mankind, and who initiates the bridge between the physical and the spiritual, who surrenders everything to follow God to destinations unknown, who imprints his quality upon the Jewish soul forever. He who is singular in this world as God is singular in his abode, and who is the spiritual father of all believers in the one God. So, based on all that, is it at all improbable to suggest that this Abraham is a partner with God, an associate of God, as it were? So does he apparently view the relationship, negotiating with God as if he were a full-fledged member of the divine court. So we find that Avraham is viewed not just as a great person, but as God's partner in bringing the world to its purpose. Now, of course, he's a human being, and it didn't have to be him. Some other person could have risen up and done what Avraham did. But Avraham is the one who took it on. Avraham saw it, and he acted upon it, and he brought God's name to the entire world to this very day. I remember seeing years back, National Geographic had a cover story called Abraham. And it's talking about Abraham's contributions to world history. National Geographic, they spoke about in the article how this is one human being that's impacted a majority of the human race. It's incredible. So God views Abraham more than just a human being who's very righteous. God views him as a partner in creation, as Rabbi Feldman suggests. And therefore, when God says, I'm about to destroy the world, how can I not tell my partner about this? This is my business partner. We're in it together, as it were. So if I'm going to come and destroy part of the world, I better divulge the information to my partner before I do it. That's what Rabbi Feldman describes it. But it's an important lesson for us in how we view Avraham. The Avraham is somebody who is not just a great person, but he becomes the partner in bringing God's message into the creation. So Avraham's response here is very interesting as well. So Avraham, number one, Rabbi Feldman points out, Avraham debates with God as if he's an equal. You know, he says, really, if they destroy Sodom, maybe we could talk about this, you know, let's haggle a little bit. And they go through a whole conversation back and forth. Maybe we can save Sodom in some way. But I think the more astounding point about Avraham's conversation with God is that Avraham is somebody who we view as the pillar of kindness, the Amud HaChesed. He's somebody who stands for helping others, caring for guests, giving to others, charity. That's what he stands for. And he's here to save Sodom, which is the antithesis of what he personally has devoted his life to. He's devoted over 100, you know, we're talking now about 100 years or so, even more than, you know, about 100, I don't know what point this is happening, let's say 100 years or so, to chesed and kindness and giving to others. And despite that, he does whatever he can to save Sodom. He fails at the end, but he tries to debate with God, why are you destroying them? Now, to me, it's a very powerful lesson, because we would think these are Avraham's arch enemies. These are his, you know, it's the antithesis of what he stands for. He should say, thank God they're being destroyed. I'm so excited that you're, it's about time, God, you know, thank you. That's what he should have said. But it tells us so much about Avraham, because the reason Avraham did chesed, he wasn't doing it to further himself. He was doing it because he really loved people. He had a true love for human beings. And therefore, even if these people were against everything he stood for, he wanted the good for all people. He said that the midas chesed of Avraham, his attribute of kindness, wasn't because he was trying to score points in heaven. It wasn't because he felt good when he was doing good to others. It was because that he really loved others. And that's why he brought the message of God to the world. He could have said, okay, you know, I found God. I have a great relationship with God. I'll get a lot of reward for eternity. Why should I spend my time bringing the message to others? And the answer is because he cared for others. He wanted to bring everybody good. And the way you bring others good is you give them the best good possible. And he felt the best good I can bring you is a relationship to God, as Avraham felt. So even people in Sodom who were wicked, and they were the antithesis of what he actually stood for, he said, I don't want them to die. I'd much rather them survive, because I love people. Maybe we can bring the message of God to them. If there's somebody righteous around, maybe we can inspire them in some way. And that was, that tells us so much about who Avraham was. You know, there's the story about the altar of Kelm. You know, one of the great figures in, I guess, pre-war Europe. And the altar of Kelm, usually during, he wasn't a very healthy person. During the week, he always looked a little bit weak, and a little pale. But on Shabbos, he would always like shine. He would glow on Shabbos. You know, on Shabbos, he was somebody that, you know, just the inspiration, the beauty of Shabbos just gave him a new feeling of life. And he walked around on Shabbos looking like a different man. During the week, he was always a little pale and weak. So the story goes that one Shabbos, he looked out of it. He didn't have his Shabbos look on. He didn't look, you know, bright and alive, energetic. And all of his students were kind of, you know, they were a little, they thought it was strange. They knew something was off. They couldn't figure out what, but they didn't want to ask him on Shabbos what's wrong. So after Shabbos, someone asked him, you know, why, we could tell this Shabbos that you were very distraught, what was wrong? So the altar of Kelm said that, I heard before Shabbos that that Peret Smolenskin died. Peret Smolenskin was one of the leaders of the movement of Maskilim. This is a movement that tried to close down yeshivas. They fought against the religious Jews, and they're trying to secularize Judaism, basically. And one of the leaders of this movement, his name is Peret Smolenskin. And this is somebody who was really the antithesis of what the altar of Kelm stood for. He devoted his life to spread Torah in the service of God. And Peret Smolenskin devoted his life to destroying Torah, closing down yeshivas, Jewish education, and secularizing Jews. So you would think that the altar of Kelm when Peres Munskin died, should be celebrating. No, he should be extra happy that Shabbos. He should be dancing and singing. Finally, my enemies have fallen. But yet, that Shabbos looks so distraught. So he explained that I'm so distraught because I'm picturing the pain of his soul up in heaven right now. When he goes and he greets God, and God says to him, how do you spend your life trying to destroy my goals in this world, destroy my Torah? Imagine the pain of that person. So the altar of Kelm wasn't celebrating his victory, he was feeling for other Jews. Now Avraham didn't celebrate the destruction of Sodom, he felt for other people. I don't want them to be destroyed, I want to do whatever I can to bring them good, I don't want them to be eliminated. I think it's a very similar approach. So some people who truly love others, and we don't celebrate the downfall of the wicked, that we feel distraught that they have to suffer and that we couldn't bring them back to the good. And it's true in general. Rabbi Feldman also has a different article. You know, he writes about how there's many times in history we've seen Jewish movements that have risen and fallen. And we usually would say it's because, you know, the truth has won out, and those movements that were not in line with the truth of Torah, you know, they haven't survived. So Rabbi Feldman says, well, so we should celebrate, right? Look, the truth has won out, and everyone who rises up against Torah doesn't survive. Then he says, well, if you think about it, that's a terrible approach. Because even though that movement didn't survive, how about all those Jews that fell with that movement, that became assimilated, secularized, became Christians because they weren't clinging to Torah's ways? We shouldn't be happy that the truth, the truth is going to win out. God's truth will win out. But we should feel distraught that we haven't helped out those Jews that did assimilate. That's how Rabbi Feldman puts it. So we don't celebrate when the wicked are destroyed. We don't celebrate when Jews, even those Jews who are standing against our values, are lost. Rather, we should feel sad that we weren't able to reach out and help them prior to this tragedy. So that's another lesson you get from the story of Sodom. Now there's another point here. I don't want to get into a political discussion. I don't mean this by this point. I try to avoid politics usually at all costs. So it might sound political, but I'll tell you why it's not. Rav Ruchem Levavitz, the Mashkiach of the Mir Yeshiva, back in the 1920s, 1930s, he writes a fascinating thing about Sodom as well. He brings a proof from Rashi that even though Sodom did not welcome guests, you can come in for a day or two, and that was okay. If you want to stay long-term, 3, 4, 5 days or plus, then that's when they get upset. And there's a source that Rashi says that it seems to be that they would work. What?
Mark Caleb talks about Sodom,
yeah,
with the tzedakah, the way they did it.
Right.
And he gets into the rebuild thing also. But basically, their tzedakah was a very interesting tzedakah. That each person in the city
write their name. Yeah, and they wrote their name on it. Right.
And then you could take that coin anywhere you wanted, and nobody would.
No one sell you food.
And right. Then eventually you would die.
Right.
And then they would
everyone take their coins back. Right.
And that's what the problem with Reba. They found this guy had gotten the coins.
Right.
And he was still alive.
Right.
And they investigated, and they found out it was Lot's daughter Reba that had given the food to him, and they.
Right. Right, yeah. So it wasn't really stucco. It was just a plot, right. Deception.
Exactly.
But the point that Rav Yeruchem makes is the following. He says, you're allowed to stay in Sodom for a couple of days, and that was okay. But you couldn't stay longer. No long-term stays in Sodom. So he actually draws a parallel. He says that it used to be, you go back, you know, a few hundred years, people could travel country to country, cross borders, and they didn't need to show a passport or a visa. The idea of having a passport visa is a modern thing. Usually, if you go to a country, you have to follow their laws. But there wasn't so much restriction in traveling between countries. In Sodom, but nowadays, you want to travel to another country, you have to have your passport, you have to have a visa for any amount of days, or else they throw you out officially, they should throw you out of the country. So he wants to draw a parallel and say that really, we should welcome in all who want to come into a country. Welcome all immigrants. Now, I don't want to get political, I'm not saying legal, illegal, taxes, that's not my point. You know, obviously it has to be security concerns, and you want to be able to do it legally so people actually can pay taxes. I'm not getting into that discussion. But he says the idea that your country has prosperity and you don't want people to come in and share the wealth, says that seems to be a Sodom-like idea. We as Jews know what it's like, what it was like back in the 1920s and 30s, when so many Jews were trying to enter into America, and America said, no, we've quotas us, and refused them. I'm sure you've all heard stories of ships that reached the American shores and were turned back to Europe, and the people were killed in the war because of it. The idea that there should, and the quotas were made typically because it's going to limit our jobs, it'll limit our prosperity. You know, we have so much here in America, And he actually quotes America. He was living in Poland. He quotes America as an example of this. But it wasn't just America. It was many, many countries. But it's, you know, we don't want to share our wealth. We'd rather, you know, we want to make sure things are limited so that, you know, we can maintain our standard of living. So again, I don't want to get into legal, illegal, that type of thing. But the idea that we should not have quotas welcome immigrants, Rabbi Rochem Levavitz says, it seems to be a very Jewish idea that immigrants should be welcomed and even encouraged to enter into a country that has prosperity to help them out. Stone was a place that they didn't allow immigrants. They would let you come in and stay temporarily, but if you overstayed your visa, then they would do all sorts of cruel and terrible things to you. That's how the Torah describes it. So I think it's a very important often to get just a Torah perspective on modern issues. You always have to figure out, what does the Torah say about, you know, issues that come up in the news and politics? So again, I'm not getting into no political issues, but just the idea of having open borders, not in an illegal way, but to let immigrants in, let them come in to settle legally, let's say. That does seem to be a Torah idea, and it's something that Sodom is blamed that they did not let immigrants into the city. So, and then he says, well, what about the idea of jobs? Now, maybe there aren't enough jobs to go around. Maybe there's not enough money to go around. He says, you know, God has enough jobs. Don't worry. God has enough money. And if we have trust in God and we do our best to help others, then God will care for us as well. So that he says, that's not for a believer in God. So again, you can't blame the American government. They're not necessarily believers in God like a Jew would be. But for believers in God to say that we're going to limit our quotas because we're concerned for jobs, is, don't worry, you know, God will be sure if you're doing the right thing, there's enough jobs for everybody. Yeah.
But wouldn't Lot have been considered an immigrant?
That's a good question. I think he was allowed in because he was very wealthy. So they wanted him to come in to spread his wealth. Okay. Abraham was very wealthy, and Lot got a good portion of that wealth as well. I think that's, by the way, this is a good question.
That's why they had to divide up. The land wasn't enough to support all their flocks.
Yes, right, yeah, right.
But was coming in as a visitor, who's coming in as a resident.
But they didn't allow immigrants either.
What?
They didn't allow residents. You know, once you were, they didn't want those to come in and even move in.
Rich ones.
Rich ones. Yeah, rich ones. Yeah, I think even if you wanted to immigrate, so they didn't want you to take any of their prosperity. They didn't want to share any of the wealth with you. So that's another lesson, and it's an important perspective, a modern day discussion of how the Torah views the idea of immigration. Let's take a look at that. Another lesson. And this one, I think, is a very important lesson as well. We spent a lot of time last year on the book of Ruth, the story of Ruth. And we know that Ruth, she descended from Lot in his relationship with his daughter. Ruth came from the land of Moab. Moab was born of the relationship of Lot with his daughter. So the sages actually tell us that it wasn't a coincidence that this was the lineage of Ruth. The sages say, based on a pasuk, the verse tells us, "Masasi David Avdi." God says, "I found David my servant." So the Gemara says, "Where'd you find him?" And finding him means like I found him somewhere. So the Gemara says, "I found him in Sodom. I found David in Sodom." Now, why is that? Because Ruth was King David's great grandmother. And she descended from Lot and his daughters who were in Sodom. Therefore, King David himself, his seeds were planted in Sodom. That's what the Gemara is telling us. Now, it's a very funny thing. Because, number one, like, why would somebody who we view as such a righteous person find his roots in Sodom? Number two, as we've said over and over again, Sodom, you know, their main evil was their lack of caring for others and charity. The role of the Jewish king is supposed to be that I'm here to care for others. It says in Pirkei Avos, there's three pillars of the world. There is Torah, Avodah, the service of God, and Gemilas Chasadim, and kindness. And commentaries describe that the Jews have three crowns. There's the crown of Torah, there's the crown of Kahuna, being a Kohen, there's the crown of Malchus, so being a king. So the crown of Torah obviously goes with the pillar of the world called Torah. The crown of a Kohen associates with service of God. And the crown of a king associates with kindness, Chesed. So king's job is to do chesed. So King David, who stands for, I am here to do chesed and care for the nation, he was found in Sodom. And furthermore, when we studied the book of Ruth last year, we spoke about at length that Ruth's greatest virtue was chesed. Now she's told that I've seen the great chesed you did with your mother-in-law. She's also a pillar of kindness and chesed for the Jews. And she was found in Sodom, is what the sages are telling us. It wasn't just she happened to descend from it. It's as if God orchestrated it that she should actually descend from Sodom in some way. This is part of the plan. So why would it be that people who stand for the whole the trait of chesed, of kindness, and people who are there in, for us as the paradigm of chesed, why would they descend from Sodom? And then that's a question that I was thinking about recently. So I think the answer is the following. It's that the way that the God creates the world and every human being is that the greater you can become in one area also means the greater you can fall in that area. For instance, let's say somebody has great leadership qualities. So you can become a leader and inspire others to good, or you can inspire them all to evil. You're a leader. So you have the ability to lead, and you can do tremendous things, or you can do horrible things. I like to quote the example, you know, Hitler, Yimach Shemo. Hitler is somebody who was a tremendous leader. He was able to take hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, and bring them to do his evil goals. Had he taken that same power he had and tried to use it for the good, he could have changed the world for the good. He had that quality within him. Just he took it down into the dumps instead of up into the heavens. That's what he did. The way that God creates us is that he gives everybody talents. In the areas in which you can excel to your greatest, you can also fail at your greatest as well. Now, the other analogy I would give, it's like a steam engine. So if you have a very powerful engine, you can hitch onto it whatever you want, and it'll take it somewhere. So you hitch on good things, it takes the good things somewhere. Hitch on bad things, it's bad things somewhere. If it's a weak engine, it's not going anywhere anyways. So it never hits you on, it doesn't move very far. So within ourselves as well, if we have certain traits that we feel are mediocre, so we can't do all that much of them for the good or for the bad. It's just mediocre. But the traits that we have, which we feel we excel in, so we can excel in those traits and do incredible things, or we can use the traits and do terrible things. So the city of Sodom, the fact that they sunk to the depths of the lack of chesed, of cruelty, by helping others, means that the potential is there to do incredible kindness. Why did God give them so much prosperity? Why did God create a place like Sodom, a place that he compared to Gan Eden, to the Garden of Eden? And the answer, I think, is because had they used their prosperity properly, they would have been a paradigm of chesed. They would have been a bastion of kindness. They'd have supported the entire world from Sodom. They could have taken all that they had and helped out thousands of people with their wealth and with their prosperity. But instead of taking that kindness and that wealth that they had and using it for the good, they became selfish and they sunk to the depths of the opposite direction. They became very, very selfish and self-focused and didn't give to anybody else. But the potential was there that they could have grown and become great Baalei Chesed. You know, people who don't have that much prosperity, they can't give so much, they can't be so selfish either, because there's not much there in the first place. When you have so much wealth, you have so much you can use to help others, and so much that you can be selfish with. It depends which direction you take it in. It's a concept, we say, Zelu Mazeh Baruch Hem. God created everything, you know, one opposite the other. It's like for every reaction, there's equal. Every action is equal and opposite reaction. You know, there's always an equal and opposite pull in both directions. So Sodom is a place that those people in Sodom that did chesed, they excelled in chesed to the heights. But those who didn't do chesed in Sodom, they sunk to the depths of selfishness and of cruelty. But it's because of that same potential is there in both directions. Lot did chesed in Sodom. We see him taking in guests and risking his life to care for guests. He was somebody who was so devoted to chesed, he learned it from his uncle Abraham, but he was so devoted to it that he actually risked his life for chesed. So the fact that Rus comes from Sodom is because there was a part of Sodom that could have hit the heights of chesed, that was excelled in chesed. And Rus was that spark of goodness that God saw in Sodom and pulled out of it. That there were people. Lot was somebody in Sodom who was able to stand up to the challenge of the cruelty. He was able to do chesed in Sodom, so he was able to do a tremendously intensely powerful type of chesed. And he created within himself the ability to produce Rus, someone of her quality and her caliber, and then King David, who is somebody who stands for us as the pillar of chesed, you know, for all of eternity. So that's a lesson we can learn from Sodom. It's very practical for us as well. Different commentaries describe that within ourselves, you know, how do we know where is our greatest potential to do good? And they say, well, often it's the part you struggle with the most. The area in your life that you feel you have a big struggle with, that is a sign from God. That area is an area you can excel in as well. Because if you don't struggle with it, that means that it's not so difficult for you to, it's just like a mediocre part of yourself. But when you have a big struggle in a certain area, So that means that God's giving me a challenge here because I can do so well in this area, I also have a big challenge in the area. Because it always goes in both directions. There has to be an equal playing field between the good and the evil in a person. So somebody who, let's say somebody who struggles with being stingy, that means they could excel in generosity. Somebody who easily gives out money, so then they won't excel and they won't fall. That's a mediocre trait of theirs. And very often it's an indicating factor in ourselves. Where do we have our greatest struggles? And that can become our greatest virtue as well. So that's the Sodom, its greatest struggle was in selfishness and cruelty, but their greatest virtue could have been kindness and chesed, but they blew it. That's another lesson of Sodom. One more quick, just a fascinating story. The story of Sodom ends. So Sodom is destroyed. Lot and his daughters were saved. And, you know, they're in a cave. They think that only human beings left on the face of the earth. So his daughters decide we have to reproduce. They spend the night with their father. They conceive and they both have children. And they felt this is the way they carry on the human race. They were obviously wrong because not everyone was destroyed. Only Sodom was destroyed, but the rest of the world still existed. But they had children through the ancestral relationship with their father. So we look at that story, and usually we have a very negative look at that story. You know, how could they do that? It was immoral. They did the wrong things. And furthermore, they named their kids Ammon and Moab, highlighting the fact that their father produced these kids. Moab means from my father, and Ben Ami is the son of my nation. So both of these children, their names actually highlighted the fact that this was from incest, and that these were children they bore with their father. So we usually look at it in a very negative way, which, you know, certainly, if you look at the way that Rashi describes it and the Torah describes it, it does seem to be an inappropriate act. But there's a fascinating story that Rav Moshe Feinstein used to tell. Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, one of the greatest gedolim ever to be in America, he began his career as a rabbi back in Russia before he came to America. And he was the rabbi of a city called Luban. I'm not sure where it is in Russia. It's in Russia somewhere. I assume somewhere in Western Russia, I guess. I don't know where. What? White Russia, yeah, somewhere in White Russia. So he used to relate the story. Rav Moshe, he was there himself, he's an eyewitness to this. Rav Moshe used to tell the story. He said that in the year 5782, so like about 100 years ago, one of the people in his community became very sick back in Russia. And he was bedridden, and he had a very strange illness. His tongue had bloated in his mouth, and he was very, very sick. So, and he was approaching death, he was so sick. So Rabbi Rav Moshe came to visit him. Rav Moshe was the rabbi of the town, so he came to visit this gentleman. And he asked that everyone should leave the room besides Rav Moshe, and he went to tell him a story. So everyone left the room, and he said, I have a story to tell you. This is on his deathbed. And he told Rav Moshe that the previous week was Parshas Vayera, last week's Parsha, and he, I guess on that Shabbos, during that week, he had asked questions about Lot's daughters. And he said, how could it be that Lot's daughters could produce the Mashiach? Meaning Lot's daughters bore Moab. Moab gave birth to Rus, and Rus gave birth to King David. That will bring to Mashiach. So how could it be that Lot's daughters could produce Mashiach? These are people who had no shame over their incest. I mean, the fact that they wanted to bear children with their father is one thing. They thought the whole world was destroyed. But the fact they named their kids Ben-Ami and Moab to highlight that they had this relationship was so inappropriate, he said. And he spoke about them in very, very disgraceful terms. So he disgraced Lot's daughters. So this gentleman then said, that night I had a dream. And these two elderly women, who were covered in a very modest way, came to him in the dream, and they said that we are Lot's daughters, and we're here to give you a message. And then they continued, and they said that they heard what he had spoken about, that about you know, disgracing them, and they came from the world of truth to give him the answer. And they said that, why do we name our kids this way? Meaning they're trying to show that we're not immoral women. We're very modest women. We named our kids these names for a very specific reason. The fascinating thing. He says, why do we name our kids this name? They said, because since we were from Avraham's family, and we were saved miraculously from Sodom, so we could have very, very easily dispelled the fact that we had incest, and we could have said the birth that we had was a virgin birth, that it came from a miraculous birth. And we actually conceived from the Shekhinah, from God, like other religions claim. And we could have started our own religion, or we could have brought about this crazy rumor that it wasn't our father that gave birth to these kids. But they didn't want to do that, because they wanted to show this is totally natural. They wanted to make everyone know that we did this for a specific reason. We're not trying to start any new miraculous religion. And therefore, we named the kids Amon, Ben Ammi, and Moav in order to show that we actually conceived from a man. And these kids are of flesh and blood, and don't attribute to them anything miraculous, and therefore don't take them as gods or divine anyway. That's what they describe to this gentleman. And because of this, the Mashiach will come from us, because we're willing to recognize this fact and shame ourselves in order to save the world from this mistake. That was our merit to have Mashiach come from us. And then they told the guy, you did a tremendous sin by disgracing us. And you spoke about us, you know, in a very, very disgraceful manner. And therefore, you're going to be punished like the spies in the desert. And the spies in the desert, we know that their tongues bloated as well. And they died a very, very cruel, unusual death. And when the man finished the story to Moshe Feinstein, the man turned his head towards the wall and he passed away. That's the end of the story. So Moshe used to tell this story. And he experienced this himself. And he told this story. So it says here that the reason he told this story was to highlight one point. And I'll highlight a second point. He used to tell this story to show the people, even in our times, are privy to divine revelations in some way. This wasn't prophecy, but the fact that in a dream he had this message, and it seemed to fit so much what was happening in terms of his illness, it definitely seems to be a message from God given to this human being. This is only 100 years ago. So Rav Moshe used to say people in our days can still be privy to divine revelations if they're on a high level. That's why Rav Moshe told this story. But I think the other message of this story is that we have to be very careful how we judge characters in the Torah. These people are living a very different life. They're living far beyond us. You know, their thought processes, their calculations, what they're privy to is very different. They're much more spiritual than we are. They live a whole different lifestyle. And you know, we don't have the right to judge their actions. What we find the Torah described, we could talk about. What we find the sages discussing, we have the right to talk about. But for us to cast judgment, well, that's beyond our pay scale, as it were. It's out of our league. You know, we're not in the place to cast judgment on people in the Torah. So again, you have places where the Torah itself, King David, David HaMelech, he sinned with Bathsheba, and he himself admits to that. So we're allowed to say the Torah says he sinned. Now the Gemara tells us that he didn't really sin. There's a way to explain it, so we can talk about it in that manner as well. But for us to cast judgment, you know, he's evil, he's wicked, we should disgrace him. That's not our position. That's not our place, and it's very risky business if we do that, because we're taking people that were light years beyond us spiritually, and bringing them down to our level. And it's important because very often you could read the Torah, the Tanakh, and you could say, "I wouldn't have done that. How are they doing that? You know, like if I was there, I wouldn't have done such a terrible thing." And these people are supposed to be these like, spiritual people, but yet they seem to be so corrupt in ways which we would never even dream of doing. And the answer is, well, we can't fully understand them. And the other answer also is, as we said before, the higher potential you have, then the bigger struggles you have as well. So we can't forget that point also in terms of this discussion. But so Rav Moshe's story, it's a fascinating story as is, but you have these two lessons. People in our day can achieve some form of divine revelation, and also we have to be so careful how we discuss people in Tanakh. So you often hear someone get up and speak about, you know, King David or Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, or speak about something that Yaakov did or something that Moshe did. And you know, if you're quoting a source from the Torah, you can quote what the Torah says. But for you to then give your personal opinion, that's already crossing a line, because who am I to judge these people that were living thousands of years ago and were on such a different plane than we are on? So I think there's a difference between talking about the story versus casting judgment. That's, you know, he was blamed for the disgraceful words he said. Yeah.
When I visit you at the yeshiva and I see the chavrusas taking place, the discussions between the study partners,
yeah,
they take different points of view. You're saying they would not necessarily take a point of view that might try to determine what was the thought of the people in the Bible or in the way that the Torah is putting it forth.
That's a good question. What I would tell you, when the boys in the yeshiva might be arguing with different points of view, they're arguing what does the text mean? How do we interpret this text? They're not saying this is what I think. They're saying this is what I think the text says. That's very different statements. Mm-hmm. But I say, you know, if the text says something about Lot's daughters, we can argue what the text means. But for me, it's to say I feel that these are terrible people. Well, it doesn't matter what I think. It matters what the Torah tells us. We're trying to figure out what the Torah says. So the debates you find in yeshiva, but they're supposed to be, is that they're interpreting, they're trying to interpret the text in front of them, which might mean we have different opinions of what this text actually means and how it applies, but it's not our own opinions, it's what we see in the text. I think that's the big difference. So the story of Sodom, these are just different highlights to the story of Sodom. It offers us lots of lessons in many different angles. It's a story which gets a very infamous city. It's a story which, you know, we could delve into even more at a later date, but at least these are some points we can gain from.